Hey everyone, we're the Blood and Platelets podcast, and we're back. After a bit of a hiatus, Brandon, Alex, and Chrissy are back and ready to spread those cancer-killing, survivor-inspired good vibes. We're changing it up a bit, expanding our circle beyond our three cancer-surviving stories, and we'll be hosting guests each new episode to share their story and experience, with the goal of spreading healing vibes and helping others in need of support. With that said, let's get into it.
Brandon, why don't you introduce yourself, since Paul knows us a little bit more, and then we'll have you do your intro, because we'd love to kind of get who you are, your story, your experience, and what's brought you here today. So Brandon, you want to start?
Yeah. So I'm Brandon Ito. Paul, it's great to meet you. So my story is a little bit kind of different from Alex and Chrissy's. I was actually diagnosed with AML almost 24 years ago in 1999. I went through the whole chemotherapy process, and then I had a bone marrow transplant about 6 months after I was diagnosed with my leukemia. And my search for a bone marrow donor was unique. They did the whole like A3M, they did the whole, you know, recruiting process, couldn't find anyone. I have two brothers, so they tested my brothers, and they weren't even close to matching. And then from those tests, they thought maybe a parent could be like a 50% match. So they tested my parents, they looked at my dad's blood work first, and he wasn't even close as well. And then they tested my mom, and miraculously, she was a perfect match, a 10 out of 10 match, which the doctors, nurses never even heard of. They said it was like a 0.0005% chance of a parent fully matching like that. They've seen parents match like 60%, 50%, but never 100%. So yeah, that was it'll be 24 years in October. This podcast, I also started a nonprofit organization called My Wishlist Foundation about 11 years ago. We grant wishes for pediatric cancer patients. And this podcast is just another part of this post-cancer journey that is still part of, I guess, like a healing process, and this void to always help that cancer community. I think that void's always going to be there, but this podcast, it's just another outlet. And yeah, we thank you for coming on and sharing your story, and I hope we help others and other any way we can. So thanks for being here.
Of course. Oh my gosh, 24 years.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah. What do they call a transplant when it's from a relative, like a brother or sister or parent? Is it called a haploid?
A haploid.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I just call it a miracle.
Yeah. You are a living, breathing miracle for sure.
Yeah. So Paul, obviously Alex and I, and now Brandon have been introduced to, but since this is a podcast, I would love for you to say who you are. And obviously, you know, we've brought you on to share your story as a survivor. But sort of, you know, I don't actually also know all the background. I mean, your mom and I have talked when you were going through treatment, mostly to sort of like help understand what's normal, you know, quote unquote normal. What are things that, you know, she could do to help, et cetera. Alex and I are just kind of giving you moral support. But
more than that.
But I would love to hear, like, you know, what you were doing before, everything happened, how old you were when you were diagnosed, and what were you diagnosed with, and then sort of like the progression from there. So would love to hear that.
I was diagnosed at 25 with acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Yeah, before that I was getting my foot in the film industry. I was working, you know, on set, and I even had some really exciting gigs as a camera operator for that show Whale Wars. Did you know that one on Discovery Channel?
Yeah.
So I was shooting that show with like a small team of five, you know, and it was in the middle of the ocean, and it was like high stakes, and it was like a real adventure. And so that was kind of like what I was doing before I was diagnosed with cancer.
Was that like off the coast of Japan somewhere?
It was supposed to be in Antarctica, but the ships we were following were trying to evade us, so we ended up in the South China Sea.
Whoa.
In the Indian Ocean. Yeah.
Wow.
It was really exciting.
That's stuff. Crazy.
Yeah. It was so crazy that they made a TV show out of it because it was so crazy.
Yeah.
And so we were there filming it. And, you know, it was a really formative experience. I thought, okay, this could be a big jumping off point to do like more nature, environmental documentaries, travel the world, do that stuff. And then, you know, over the course of 3 months, I just thought I had a really bad cold or something, or like the flu. And then eventually, right before I was diagnosed, I went blind in one eye. Essentially, my blood was there was so many white blood cells that I started to have hemorrhages in my softer, like my really delicate blood vessels in my eye. So in my retina, hemorrhaging blood. They would just explode. So the real danger is that
you could
have like a brain aneurysm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, wait, were you on a boat when this was happening?
No, I'd come back. I maybe been home for like 6 months or something.
Oh, and thank God.
Thank goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it really, you know, acute means quickly, so it happened very fast. And then, you know, 3 months, I was feeling weird. By that last month, I was feeling extremely sick, couldn't walk up the stairs, and then I was blind. So I went to the doctor, and, you know, they told me to go to the hospital immediately, and they wouldn't tell me why, really. They just said, you need to go to the hospital. And then I went to the hospital and didn't leave for 40 days. Oh. They just started the induction chemotherapy. And that was the beginning of the life with cancer.
You didn't go see the doctor until like a couple months after you were experiencing these flu-like symptoms?
Yeah. I didn't go for months because it was so subtle at first. You just don't notice it as it increases subtly over time, you know? And I was young. I had just gotten off of a ship that traveled around the ocean chasing pirates. Like, you know, I was just like, I'll just shake it off. I'm fine.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I started to work out harder. I started, because I was getting frustrated why I was getting so fatigued, why I was so weak. So I started work out more, and I couldn't work out as much, and I was really like, didn't understand what was going on. I was hurting myself, but the blindness, you know, some other issues, immediately red flags, and finally went to the hospital. Yeah. And then everything started. I would do chemotherapy for 3 years, and then right when I was done with chemotherapy, that was when the pandemic started. And, you know, we went through the pandemic for that first year. And then I relapsed. My cancer came back December 2020, kind of at the height of the pandemic when, the death cases were reaching like 500,000.
This was 3 years after your initial diagnosis?
4 years. Had 1 year where I didn't have to do any chemo before it relapsed.
So they didn't tell you to go to transplant right away. They just said, let's treat this with regular, like, let's see if we can just
chemo
kill it with chemo first. Then, because I know you can't go to transplant until you're under a certain ratio, but
they gave me the option. It was ultimately my choice. They said, you can go to transplant, but you do not have a strong match, and it could be risky. And, I remember the way they presented it to me was like, there's a 20% chance that it could be fatal. I was like, 20% chance?
I know.
I
was given that. Yeah. I was given that percentage at one point, and it's like, it's 1 in 5.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, what kind of transplant options were you given?
I don't remember back then. Like, I eventually would get the stem cell transplant.
Okay.
That's what I did when I relapsed. But during the first cancer diagnosis, they just said you could go to City of Hope and they would pound it out. That's what they said. they do transplants, like, all the time. You would just get a transplant.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was really scary because I was at, I just found out I had cancer like 3 days prior. They told me, there's like a 60% chance of relapse, but, you're not Philadelphia. You don't have these other genetic cases where it presents higher risk. I didn't pass the test for like completely, safe or whatever, but I didn't have the most egregious like genetic chromosome or the genetic markers that would indicate a struggle for survival.
Right.
So I just was like, I'll do chemotherapy for 3 years and we'll just go with that. 'Cause 20% was just unacceptable. It's just so scary. I didn't really realize, how terrible 3 years of chemotherapy would be as well, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it all sucks. There's no
easy way out.
Yeah.
So by the time the relapse happened, you said that was December of 2020.
Yeah.
Amazing timing.
That was brutal.
Yeah. So were you in the hospital? Talk about that. Yeah. Was like this just one, the fear of what you're going to go through, it's come back. It's always a cancer patient's worst fear. But then on top of that, we're in this pandemic and people are dying of this virus. I mean, how did you cope with that? How did your doctors talk to you, and did they lay out a game plan? Like how was that?
It was like this. So, I'm living in Las Vegas at the time. My fiance, like my now fiance, she was working in Las Vegas. So we moved there. Now we're back in LA, but we moved to Las Vegas and we spent the first year of the pandemic in Las Vegas quarantining. And I was feeling really strong. I was recovering from chemo. I was in remission. I thought, cancer was done. I did my 3 years and it should be all good. And I was getting really active again. I was feeling really strong. There's like a national park right outside of Las Vegas. So I was going on hikes a lot. And it was Thanksgiving. And, I'm feeling really good. Like, I also shot a feature film during my first cancer. Just a part of the, like, drive to survive and chasing your dreams. So I was feeling really good despite quarantine and the pandemic. But we were just eating Thanksgiving dinner alone. It was really nice. And you know, I was just feeling my neck and I felt a lump on my neck. And it was like one of the worst instances of your life, because you know that's not supposed to be there. And it, you know, for us, if it's not supposed to be there, it's not good. So I called my doctor and I could tell immediately that she was extremely concerned. And she passed me along. I no longer was under her care. Like, immediately I came, I had to go back to LA for tests, and she handed me off to USC, the Norris Cancer, Norris and Keck Cancer Center. And I did a lymph node biopsy, and it was, the cancer had relapsed. So, you know, the pandemic just made it all worse, because I had to do everything completely alone, and the rules on visitation were extremely strict. It was brutal, because, you know, you feel strong and alive and you think you beat cancer. And then they tell you, oh no, you're not strong at all. In fact, it's way worse than the first diagnosis, because the cancer cells had gone into my CNS, so my spinal fluid in my brain, which is a big scary thing to happen for ALL patients, as I imagine other leukemia patients. So immediately intrathecal chemo into the spine twice a week, three times a week, you know, got the bags. I mean, this is all terrible, right? Like, I'm talking to people that truly understand this. Like, and then on top of that, I couldn't have my family or anyone there. So
that's rough. Yeah.
I remember I got in the hospital and, you know, I thought I beat it. And then I'm staring down at the bed again. And like, even now thinking about it, I can feel like the horror of that moment. And I didn't sit down on it for a long time. I just kind of refused to sit on it. And then someone came in and I'm like crying, and they hand me an iPad with instructions in like type 25 font, teaching me how to use an iPad to talk to my relatives. I was like, oh my God, that's right. You know, I'm not supposed to be in here. I'm not supposed to be this young person who knows how to use an iPad. I'm not supposed to be here.
How did you what were some of the things you did? I mean, was it just a daily reminder of like, I don't want to die, I don't want to die, and that was sort of the mantra? What did you do, especially because you had no outside connection?
I was following your story on Instagram at that time, and you were making these like little short films about your experience. And I thought those were amazing. I couldn't wait to see the next recording that you posted. But from your recordings, I couldn't tell, like, you were going through something so traumatic. Like, you displayed a lot of courage, and it's just amazing from hearing what you're saying now, but please continue.
I would make these like little skits, like sketches. Like, I'd have my iPhone and I record some videos, some update videos. But yeah, I should have been putting it on TikTok, you know. Wasted it on Instagram. No. I do remember like going through the first cancer, I really regretted not taking more videos and sharing more on social media, because you're just so consumed. You know, I don't post on social media like a lot. I've had to do a lot more because of what I'm doing.
The movie, like, yeah.
You know. But I was like, okay, this cancer, I'm going to stay more in touch with the outside world, especially because
you're all by yourself.
I'm all by myself.
Yeah.
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 Well, I mean, I guess what a benefit to have social media. I mean, we know the negative aspects of social media, but thank goodness you had social media. I mean, when Brandon was going through his stuff.
There's no Wi-Fi. I had to use dial-up internet.
Yeah. Oh my God. If I didn't have internet, I don't know.
This is pre.
How did you get through it?
Yeah.
Literally a little 8x8 TV with like basic cable. That's all I had. There were no iPads.
And a remote that like you just.
Yeah, it only went one way.
Channel by channel.
If you skipped one channel, you'd go all the way around.
What? True hero.
Yeah.
That's criminal.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
So, like, I only have like two photos while I was in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And those are the only ones that I cycled because you had to use like film camera.
Yeah.
Or like,
yeah.
I couldn't just snap photos on my phone. It's crazy.
Yeah, oh, no. I think you made a really good point, Paul. Like, I didn't post a ton. I mean, I posted enough, but like, I also, like you said, like, it was not my focus. I just was either A, too exhausted, or B, I was just kind of like, yeah. I was in the hospital when it wasn't COVID. It was pre-COVID, so I had four people in my room at any given time, talking to me, right? So I didn't have a ton of like the, but I think it actually is, I think it's a really, I wish I had done more of it. Cause like I was looking back recently and there was something that I saw on Instagram of Alex of your journey. And maybe it was from Be the Match when they put their reel together and like, there's all these pictures and videos of you going through it. And then Paul, like Alex, when you said that, Alex, about his shorts, his little mini films, I remember that. And I think that is such a creative and useful way of documenting this highly traumatic experience. And for people who may be listening that are about to go into it or are going through it, you know, I think it sounds like something that we've all said, like, yeah, we're glad we have it, because you can kind of look back at it in therapeutic ways of being like, yes, this is what happened, and it was horribly traumatic, and it was difficult, and it was challenging physically and emotionally, but now I'm here, and now I've made it through, and, you know, it's a big part of your life. So can you tell people what that the film was called, that short one that you made, during your first bout with cancer? It was like that mini documentary. What was that called again?
I made two short films and a feature film during my first cancer. The two short films were called Leafer and Six Windows. And then the feature film was called Evergreen. Evergreen. They were all like narrative. Yeah.
And where can we watch them? Like, where can people watch them? On YouTube? How do people find it?
You can watch the short films on my YouTube channel, and you can watch the feature film on Amazon. And we have a new feature film now. You know, each time I get cancer, you just making a feature film helps, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have a new feature film now that's out, and we've been kind of touring the country with it. It's been getting a lot of really fun attention, and
is that No-No Girl?
No-No Girl. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that is partly related to your cancer experience story.
It's more related to my childhood growing up Japanese American.
Okay.
And how the family in the story has to figure out what to do with what was left behind during the incarceration of their grandparents.
Right.
It was about a yonsei, right?
Which
is fourth generation.
Fourth generation.
Right? Mm-hmm. And you yourself are yonsei?
Yes, yeah. Yeah. So
Brandon,
it's like
myself, and Paul are.
Yep.
You guys are all yonsei.
All three of us are yonsei. Yeah.
Nice.
All of our grandparents were. Yeah. Did you start writing that script during your second, like during the transplant? Did you start kind of conceptualizing it then?
Yeah. Definitely was writing it during, you know, besides, you know, I was alone, so I had a lot of time, but I was also like, I didn't stay at USC, for my bone marrow transplant. USC was having a real tough time during the pandemic. It was, you know, they had a lot to handle, a lot of volume. Yeah. There were overflows and there were like COVID patients on the floor with the bone marrow transplant patients. It was kind of rough.
Oh,
yeah.
They had them on the same floor.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
I know.
Yikes. Yeah.
And what made it worse, I mean, I don't want to, USC was, they had a lot to handle, but I went to City of Hope and had a really great experience there, you know.
Yeah.
They took care of me really well. They had an amazing facility. And it was there that I could really, you know, distress. You know, the treatments were so brutal, right? Like with the intrathecal chemos, I had, you guys had the spinal fluid chemo injections?
No, I did not. So do you want to just explain that, like what they do?
Yeah, they stick a needle in your spine and then they push chemotherapy into it. So I think I've done like over 60 of those.
Oh, wow.
I've done a lot.
So do they do like the spinal tap at the same time? Because I've had spinal taps done.
Yeah.
So when they do that, they just inject the chemo at the same time. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Yeah.
And it was usually like high dose methotrexate.
Oh.
So, you know, I was doing those multiple times a week, but it causes causes an imbalance of pressure in your brain has a pressure, like a airplane cabin or something.
Uh-huh.
So when you leak fluid out of the spinal tap, you know, the spinal fluid in your brain loses that pressure. It causes these massive headaches. And like for months I was dealing with that. It was so debilitating. Like you start to like hallucinate and stuff.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. I mean, this was a question about the script writing, but this is like, you can't write a script. I wanted to write this story. I was like, okay, I'm just going to pour all my creativity and all of my mind into writing the script. But you know, I couldn't because of the treatments and the drugs.
Sure.
And the stress of like, is someone on this floor with COVID going to get me really, really sick? Mm-hmm. But at City of Hope, there was none of that. It was quarantine, no more spinal taps, just radiation and bone marrow transplant.
Oh, okay. Okay. Oh, man, that is brutal.
Yeah.
That is brutal. But how incredible that what came out of this is now this amazing feature film that you really had wanted to put together, and you were able to do that. I mean, that's really incredible. I mean, was there a turning point in the treatment? Like, did you have a turning point after, like, once you got your transplant, once you got your stem cells?
Mm-hmm.
Did you start? Was there a moment where you were like, okay, I feel like maybe something's gonna get better? Or, because I remember like the first 2 weeks I was in the hospital, and it was the first 2 weeks after I received my stem cells on that Friday, nothing happened. Like, no counts moved, nothing happened. And I was like very scared, very depressed, very much like, what is going on? Is this not working? Like, is this not working? And then all of a sudden, and my doctor was, as we all know, like, they're so amazing there. Like, my doctor never faltered. She was never worried. She was like, no, it just takes time. we'll see, you know?
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was like almost 2 weeks exactly to the day. And that next morning after the midnight blood draw, they posted the numbers in the morning and it was like it had gone up 0.1, you know?
That
and it was
one like, blood cell.
Oh! Yeah. You know? Yeah. So did you have, like, that was, for me, that was my moment where I was like, okay, something's working. This is going to get better. And for me, mentally, that really helped. But did you have something like that happen that you can recall, or was it more just a steady, like, perseverance?
I think the thing, and I remember that really made a difference, you know, just like you, nothing happens, right?
Yeah.
The radiation, the bone marrow transplant, is really painful. So, you know, it feels like your body's turning inside out. And it was just hard to get through for the first 2 weeks of that. And I had been alone for like 4 months doing all the treatments.
Oh my God.
So it was just, it was like a real test. Like, how bad do you want this? How bad do you want to live?
Yeah.
And I wasn't concerned about my blood count. I don't remember being like, what's my numbers? I was just like, fuck this, just survive today.
Yeah.
And the real thing that changed for me was that City of Hope changed their policy one day and they allowed a visitor, but they had to stay in the room with me. They couldn't leave.
Mm-hmm.
So my fiance V came in and she stayed in the room with me for 2 weeks.
Mm. Amazing.
Wow.
And that gave you strength to fight on, and the spirit that wasn't there prior to that, right? I can just feel it. That's amazing.
That's amazing, Paul.
It makes a huge difference, man, to have somebody there to just all kinds of support, not just emotional, but just a voice, a person that you could feel like, you know, in your heart and in your hand, and
the energy of them. Yeah.
I mean, I'm getting emotional right thinking about it.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like it was just like being on a deserted island of pain, and then having a lifeline.
Yeah.
You know, I think we all felt like we were on a deserted island, but you were on a more deserted island than we ever could imagine.
You know, you were on another planet.
Yeah.
We were on Mars. We were at least still on Earth. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that is so brutal, but that's incredible. And I feel like there's two things that you said are like really amazing. One is that you did survive those 4.5 months in solitude dealing with this incredible pain and illness and struggle. And my God, what a testament to the power of the willpower of saying, like you just said, like, fuck, just survive today. Just survive today. I'll get to tomorrow, you know?
Yeah.
That's incredible. And then the second part of that of then what it really does, like just having that human connection with someone else is everything. It's like everything.
It's
energy of someone else and just knowing you're not alone. And, you know, Mark did the same thing. I mean, he didn't leave for almost 3 weeks. He stayed in the hospital. And the first night that he went home, because he was like, I need to go back and do laundry. And I was getting better at this point. So it's like not as, but I like totally freaked out that first night and called him and I was crying. I was like, I don't think I can do this. Like, can you come back, please? And he did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like, I think for people who are, you know, scared about going through something like this, the fear is real, but like knowing that you have support and knowing that you have someone there that can really be like that lifeline for you is so important and it's so amazing. Mm-hmm. I felt that, Paul, when you're talking about that. Oh my gosh,
I can't even
imagine what your wedding's gonna be like.
I know, we're getting married in 2 months.
Oh, congrats. Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
So great. That's great. That's just amazing. That's amazing.
Things are going very well right now.
Yeah,
last weekend was the 2 years since my bone marrow transplant.
Yes.
Awesome.
Your new birthdays.
Yeah. I don't know about you guys, but when they gave me the bone marrow transplant, like in the bag, and you watch it go in, and you know this is going to be really painful, and you're just laying there that first night. I was completely alone, so maybe that also added to the weirdness of it, but I was just laying there, and then all the nurses come in. And they start singing me happy birthday. I was just like,
what's going on?
Episode of a Twilight Zone or something?
Yeah, it's weird. I got a balloon. I don't even think I got a singing. But I also felt like it was very anticlimactic. I was like, that's it? Like,
I guess.
We're done now?
Yeah.
Like, just a bag of stuff?
I appreciate the whole sentiment of like, you're getting a new bone marrow, but. I was a little creeped out, but I understand, you know, totally why it's a thing.
I think that's okay. I think that's normal, normal feeling. Yeah. Wow. 2 years. That's amazing. And so you're doing well, you feel good. You are count wise are healthy.
May I ask you who your donor was?
Oh yeah.
It was my sibling, Lori.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
My sister.
Oh, wow. Yeah. We did the A3M and all the bone marrow matches. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, something, Chrissy, I don't know if I ever told you, but when I was 14, I did a cheek swab for you.
Really?
And I didn't know what leukemia was.
Oh my gosh.
Because I remember Dr. Shinto came up to me and he's like, Paul, you know.
You're Hapa.
Yeah, and I think it would be really important if you registered for the bone marrow, did the bone marrow drive in the gym. And I didn't know what any of that was. So I went, I'm going to have to talk to my parents first.
I was like,
this sounds crazy. What?
You're like, my dentist told me to do this. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. But my parents were you should do it. And then, And then I went in and did the cheek swab for you. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I had no idea what leukemia was. I learned a little bit about leukemia over the next couple of days after that cheek swab.
Man, that's wow. Well, thank you.
It didn't really work.
No,
you wouldn't have wanted mine anyways. What would that have been like?
I guess,
right?
Yeah.
Oh my god! Imagine.
Well, you know, it all works out for a reason, though. I guess
she would need a refund.
Worse than that.
Oh man! Well, so your sister was your donor. That's incredible. And then. This 2 years, you're at your 2 year mark. When's your actual anniversary, like birthday? Stem cell birthday?
Yeah, it was March. I think it was like March 12th.
Oh my gosh, so it was like literally.
Yeah, it was last weekend.
Last happy belated.
1 week ago.
Yeah.
A week ago. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Congrats. Oh, Robbie. Okay. Sorry. My dad wants to come in and be a part of it.
He wants to congratulate you.
Yeah.
Yes.
He heard it is your birthday. So he's very excited about you. Well, that's great. So now what does life look like now?
We have this movie. I'm promoting and spreading this movie around. We're going to film festivals and sharing it with so many people in the Japanese American community, in LA, Southern California, and the Bay Area. And we've been to like Sacramento and Stockton and Portland and Eugene. And we were in Austin and DC. It's just been like kind of blowing up a little bit. And it's all about this Japanese American family. It's this movie about Japanese American people today and what they had to, you know, how they're still being affected from the trauma of World War II and incarceration. And people are liking it. I mean, I'm hesitant to say much about like how I feel about it because it feels so superstitious, but it's going well. I think that movie is so much tied into my recovery because, you know, after the bone marrow transplant, you get home and you're finally out of the hospital and around your family again, and you can't really walk. You know, you're so weak. Everything's like on a knife's edge. You have no immune system. And so I just like started writing emails, and I reached out to this like kind of idol of mine, Chris Tashima, who he won an Oscar in the late 90s for a short film called Vices and Virtues that he directed and starred in. So he's like an Oscar winning director and actor. And he's one of the only Japanese Americans to ever win an Oscar, period.
Oh, wow.
And I reached out to him. I think the headline was like, cancer survivor, filmmaker, wants to make his second feature film or something. You know, just fully lean into that. Because we deserve it. Hey, man,
you earned that card.
Yeah.
You earned
that card. You can always play that card. That's
that
card.
Who would take that away from you?
But,
yeah. So I sent him an email, and then I sent him the script, and he liked the script so much, he asked if there was any part, like, any way he could be a part of it. And now I had him locked into a role that I kind of wrote with him in mind. Like, if I could have someone play this role, it'd be
no way.
Yeah, but I just thought it was a long shot. You know, this guy is, like, he's a serious, serious deal. And so he got on the project, and when he got on the project, I emailed the whole crew. Like, my evergreen movie crew, like, we're tight. We've done all these films together. They supported me through cancer. They're, like, some of my closest friends, too. We all just got stoked, and I was like, okay, we're going to shoot in November because I'm going to do the bone marrow transplant and shoot this movie in the same year, and it's going to be crazy.
Jeez, yeah. Man.
I know. Wow. It was
I like ambitious. It. Nuts. I like it.
Yeah.
And that we is did so it. Incredible. Yeah, you did it.
Yeah, we totally did it. It was like, you know, I'm on set and my hair grew back all curly, so I have like
I know,
this
yeah.
weird curly hair.
Yeah.
And we totally shot the movie, and now, you know, 2 years later, 2 years after the transplant, I can celebrate like its release. So it just is kind of incredible. It's all happening right now.
Yeah. Was that a big part of, I guess, your treatment or your healing process? Like you saw the vision of like this film now. You're like, I have to beat cancer. I have to be well in order to get this done. Did that really drive you during like your treatment or healing process?
Yeah. Totally, because, you know, it was kind of the only thing that I was doing that was aimed at the future, you know, like there was nothing else I was doing where I imagined a life, you know, I was just like, you know, until you got cancer, you just assume you're going to die now and you're going to get really sick and then you're going to die. Yeah. It's kind of bleak. But writing the script is like this subconscious little fight because if I'm writing this script, I'm going to shoot it. And if I'm going to shoot it, that means I'm going to be out of the hospital. I'm going to be healthy enough to shoot. I'm going to have something in the future. So in a way it was like maybe the only thing that was giving me hope, you know, tangibly. You know, of course, my family and my friends and all that. But personally, for me, there was no, I wasn't making birthday plans, you know, I was just writing this script. And it was kind of, it was like that little fight.
That's awesome.
And the movie was the completion of it.
Wow.
The power of your subconscious.
A little bit, possibly. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's incredible.
You know, I was watching the Oscars last week, and I was having, like, these visions of Mr. Paul Goodman accepting his award one of these days.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, I was talking to you last week, and then the Oscars came on, and, you know, your films, and, yeah, I can totally see it. I can totally see it down the line, and that would be amazing.
Ki Hui Kwan looked into the camera and pointed. It felt like he was pointing at me. He was just like, follow your dreams. Yes, yes, sir.
Yeah, dude. It was. That's amazing.
I think he was pointing at all of us.
Yeah.
But, that was incredible. But yes, I agree with Alex. I'm waiting waiting for your category and your nomination to happen for No No Girl. I've been I've been dying to see it. So. Are you going to be able to come back and do more screenings in L.A.?
Yeah. So, living back in L.A., we had a run of screenings in, like, September, October. Kind of like August, September, October. And we had, like, we sold, like, 2,000. There were, like, 2,000 people came to see it in those, like, in those limited screenings. Wow. Yeah.
That's great.
And that kind of jump-started the rest of the tour. But now that we've done all these other cities and stuff, I think there's more attention for another screening in Southern California. And I think we're going to try and schedule a couple, you know, in the summertime. Hopefully we can do like a week or something.
That'd be awesome.
We will be there.
Yeah.
We'll definitely be there.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Keep us posted on that.
Yeah,
and we'll post it on the podcast.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we want to get you some with all of our many,
I need the blood and platelet
15 bump. Listeners maybe, I don't know.
Well, I'm gonna put this on my social media and everything. I love this podcast.
Great. Good. Well, with that then, I mean, we're almost at time, but what I want to do is I'd love for you to, with that said, how, like, you have anything for those that are currently experiencing, right, where we were, and this is really the point of the podcast, is to give people who are either in their current fight or are just beginning it or are just coming out of it, right? Is there anything that you would say to yourself back then, you know, like now where you are, is there anything we always talk about, like what things would we want to hear ourselves, you know, but is there anything that you have that you've kind of like settled on where you want to share?
You know, something that I think is really reassuring now is that the technology is getting so good. Like, even with leukemia, when I started leukemia, there was no CAR T cell, there was no blinatumomab, there was none of these things, where now it's kind of common and you can get these really advanced, great procedures. I imagine it's the same across many different cancers. So in a kind of weird and sick way, like, you just have to survive a little bit longer. Like, the technology is going to be there very soon. We're getting really good at treating these diseases. And I can't speak for all cancers, right? I can really only speak for acute lymphoblastic leukemia B cell. And, you know, for those going into cancer treatments right now, just...
Yeah, you know, so bone marrow transplants have only been around for like 40 some years or something.
40 or 50 years.
You know,
and that, like, my only option was bone marrow at the time.
Yeah, they didn't do stem cells back then.
Yeah.
You're right.
I agree. The medical technology is advancing, and if you could hang on, you know, like, your chances will get better year after year.
Every day you survive, the chances get better and better for you to find a cure.
I believe it too. And the registry is gaining more donors.
Growing,
It's growing up.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we should make a t-shirt from Paul, and it's going to say, just effing survive today.
Yeah.
That's yeah. That's how we're
That'll be the title it. Of the this one, just effing survive.
Effing survive today.
I think this, man. If I was to give, like, legitimately one piece of advice, that would pretty much be it. Just get through the day.
The day.
Hold on to the things that make you feel strong, friends, family, or writing a script or whatever it is, you know, just effing survive today and then effing survive tomorrow, but worry about that tomorrow.
Yeah. I love that. That's great. That's so great. Thank you, man.
Yeah. Paul, thanks so you much, guys. You're amazing, dude. Like, thank you.
You are. You really
guys were
are.
Such a big help. When I was going through, well, it was before transplant, you guys were such big mentors. You relaxed me. You made me feel like I was, you know, if this was, this is going to work and it's going to be okay. So I really appreciate that.
I'm so glad. I'm really glad that it did help you. We were thinking about you a lot. Still do. But yeah. Anytime you need a cheerleading section, Brandon, Alex, and I are there.
Yes.
Yeah. But thank you, man. Thank you for your time, for sharing your story. I think it's so incredible what you went through and survived. I think it's amazing. So,
all of us.
So happy you're here. So happy.
Yeah. Brandon didn't even have internet.
Nope.
That's the worst one.
Yeah. I mean, thinking really back now, it's crazy.
How
I had nothing to do.
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. Like a doodle pad.
And like, I'm not a reader, so like, I didn't read any books. It was
just a true hero.
Poor guy.
Oh, man. Did you have Nintendo?
They did, but I'm not a video game person either. So I know that probably the 6 months I was in the hospital, my brain probably just turned to mush.
Counting the drops out of the bag.
Yeah.
Oh my god. You're
counting the days, making scratches on the wall.
Yeah. Right.
Like
scratches on the wall.
Different times. Different times.
Like we said, technology is really advanced. It's great.
Yeah. In more than one way.
Oh my gosh.
Oh man. All right, guys. Well, thank you, Paul. Yes. Thank you again.
Thanks again, so Paul.
So good to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you, great to meet you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on.
All right.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
See ya,
everyone.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.